Hey, we are live, yeah.
We're ready to go?
Yep. We're ready to get started.
Yeah. All right. I call to order the General Employees Pension Board quarterly meeting. It is Monday, September 15th, 2025 at 10:11 a.m. Roll call, please.
Sure. Brenda DeWeese.
Here.
Delinda Talley.
Here.
Tim Sopko.
Here.
Tommy Hilton. Bridget Bossieri. Okay, we still have a quorum of three.
Okay. Item number two is public comments, and being no public, we'll move on to item number three, approval of the minutes. Is there any changes or corrections to the minutes of the meeting?
No.
Not that I saw.
None for me.
Look for a motion to approve.
I make a motion to approve the minutes.
Second?
Second it.
Just you two.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Get ready, you're going to... Use your voice today.
All in favor?
Aye.
Say aye.
All opposed? Motion approved. Item number four, reports. Up first, Foster and Foster, Mr. Doug Lozen.
I read that.
Yeah.
H5. Welcome.
We have to turn the mic on, Doug. I'm not sure. I want to make sure that Bonnie, can you hear us?
There we go.
I can. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
On the tablets, it's page 5 of 58. I've been going around the state all summer showing these to different groups. Most of the time, it's a cost increase, some cost decrease. Here with Edgewater General, it's modest, and I'll explain it. I want to make sure you're all on page 5, our September 2nd letter.
Yep.
If you just go down to the city required contribution, just take the difference there in those two bottom numbers, and you can see it's about $7,000 a year. It's hardly anything. But it, as a reminder, you say, well, you know, why? What'd you do, Doug? You do a study for Edgewater to find how long people are living? No, I could never. I couldn't do that even if I was tasked to say for a big city like Tampa or Miami, they're not big enough. You need
lots of
a lot of people because fortunately mortality for, you know, the probability in any given year, unless you're, you know, over the age of 90, it's fairly low. We all understand it starts very, very low in the early years, you know, like fractions out of, you know, a few hundred thousand people. And by the time you get to 100, you're flipping a coin. So with the pension plan, it's very important that we get a handle on how long do we expect people to live, because a pension plan, it's a check paid for life. And so you want some reasonable estimate of how long people are living. So I've never, as the actuary, come to you and said, oh, here's what's going on with Edgewater life expectancy. You should use this assumption. I can do that for... turnover, I can do it for salaries. I mean, these are things that are actually observable that are happening every year to everybody in the plan. Everybody gets a salary increase. The membership, every year there's a certain percentage that terminate employment. I know for general where it's a closed plan, but I'm talking like for the police and fire. So you might be wondering, it's like, well, then why are you even come to us? You know, why are we talking about this? Well, because the lawmakers in Tallahassee about a dozen years ago, they passed a law, a statute, that requires that all public sector pension plans in Florida mirror whatever the Florida retirement system is using for life expectancy. And whenever a change is made by the FRS, then we have to adopt it. We have to link to it within 2 years. And so, lo and behold, Florida Retirement System adopted a new mortality assumption with their July 1st, 2024 report, so we have to implement it with the next report. So I brought this to your attention when I was here last meeting and asked if you'd like to see an advance study on it. And so here we are. So the big picture is for the male retirees, they are – on average, expected to live a little bit longer compared to the old assumption. by, you know, maybe a little bit less than a year. In some cases, the younger male retirees maybe a little bit more than a year, but on average, you know, between half and 1 year. The females, it's kind of a push, the female retirees. The younger female retirees might be expected to live a little bit longer. The older ones, maybe a little less. And so you might be wondering, it's like, well, what do you mean live longer, live less? It's all relative to the last assumption that was adopted. The last time we had to do this, there was a study done. And so we said, well, FRS did this study, so let's use it. Now there's a new study. And there is, I do think, validity to it. Because the study is done not just by the Florida Retirement System Actuary, it's a company called Milliman. They take data from all of the plans in the state that participate with Florida Retirement System. So there's hundreds of thousands of lives. And they submit that mortality experience to an organization called the Society of Actuaries. And the Society of Actuaries collects similar data from all the large pension plans around the country. So you've got millions and millions of lives and statistics regarding mortality. And it's further subdivided by just those who participate in public pension plans. So this is, I probably think, on average, fairly representative, that your Edgewater General is a public sector pension plan. This mortality assumption is based on public sector pension plan general employees, with the caveat that it's from around the country, the average. So again, while I think that's very valid and it's a completely reasonable assumption, whether it holds true for Edgewater General experience, we'll never know. The only way we would ever know is if we'd have to go forward many, many decades in the future and then look back at all of the mortality experience. And even then, Edgewater is a really small city. So even if you added up 100 years worth of lives, it still might not be significant enough to ever say, well, it was correct for the Florida Retirement System assumption. Who knows? All we can do is just adopt. But generally speaking, people are living a little bit longer on average. And these studies are updated about every 5 years or so. So I'll almost certainly probably be coming to you in the future with some additional updates. So if you want, let's just look at just a couple of sample examples, just so you can see, maybe smirk a little bit of how long I think you're all going to live.
I noticed I'm going to live longer. I like it.
I threw a couple of fun tables in here. It's, you know. Let's look at the table. It has updated mortality assumptions. And I'm going to randomly pick a 65-year-old male. I just did it on the fly. So look at that chart on the left, 65, and go over to the fourth column from the left. And the number you should be looking at, you see that 21.34?
Mm-hmm.
That is how long the new table says a 65-year-old retired male will live. That means another 21.34 years. So just add the two numbers. Like, oh, if I'm 65 and I'm a retiree and I'm a male, I'm expected to live to 86 in like 4 months. I'm going to switch tablets.
Thank you. I am so sorry for being late.
Oh, no worries. I'm just getting ready to tell you how long you're going to live. And...
Oh, good. Well, I'm living to be 100, so
there you go.
What this says.
That's exactly what I expect.
Oh, great. The plan's going to appreciate that.
That's okay. I'll happily report mortality losses. That is just fine. Okay, what I was just covering was the table I'm just on. It's page 6 of 58. I was explaining how the mortality assumption is impacting Edgewater General. It's very, very minor. So I'm just going through a couple examples here. So a 65-year-old healthy male is expected to live another 21.34 years. That's, you can just go down to the age 65 and over four columns. So 86 and call it 4 months. So the question is, the old assumption, what were we, how long were we expecting a 65-year-old male to live? If you just scroll down one page, find the 65, and go over for that same male, it was 20.82 years. That's what we're currently, it's a minor difference. It's 85.82 currently, now it's 86.34. Okay, well, that's for a male. Let's pick a 65-year-old female, and still the actuaries and God are discriminatory because they expect women to live longer than men. So still unchanged, still undefeated. So 65-year-old female, retiree healthy, under the new assumption is expected to live to 88.48. See, that just takes 65 plus 23.48. So that's a little more than 2 years longer than men. Go, so remember that, 88.48. Okay, now go down one page. How long under the current assumption was that 65-year-old female expected to live? And it was 86.84. I'm sorry, 88.84. 65 plus 23.84. So for the female 65-year-old, while she's still living longer than the 65-year-old male, it's a little bit less than the current assumption. And that explains why the impact to the city was only that $7,000 or so. The men largely are expected to live a little bit longer. The women, the females, about the same. If they're younger, maybe a little bit longer. If they're a little bit older, then a little bit less. And so overall, it's almost a push. And again, these are all assumptions. I have no clue whether, you know, you can't look at this and say, oh, I'm this age, so I'm going to get hit by a bus when I'm 88 in 10 months.
I hope so.
These are all averages. And these are all healthy, assumed healthy. You know, I'm going to get off the stage here and let Frank get out with his report. You need to hear the good news on, you know, on investments. But if you look at the disability section, clearly the disabled lives much shorter. And the final note I'll make here is that the underlying assumption still assumes improvements in the future. We use this underlying table that we have for a dozen years now. And it assumes, say, for example, that somebody aged 60 today, and you pick the number of years they're expected to live, 20 years from now, somebody age 60 is expected to live a couple of years longer. That's called generational mortality improvements. But that's based on current studies, current recommendations, current assumptions. Actuaries update these every 5 years or so, and they keep tabs worldwide on what life expectancy is going to be. None of this presumes, I don't believe, like pandemics or anything like that. And by the way, this table does not include anything to do with COVID. The assumption that is it's an outlier event, and if we had included it, we'd probably be showing shorter life expectancy across the board. But these are look forwards. These are from this point forward. You know, we're not counting people who have passed; they're gone. We're thinking, okay, from this point forward, how long do we expect people to live? And if they got through COVID, then the general expectancy is they're going to continue living longer. So that's, I think, all I want to talk about mortality. I assume you don't have any questions.
On the contribution requirement, is that for next year?
Very good question. We're going to implement it with the next valuation, 10-1-25. So it will be for the city's 26-27 year.
Okay.
I measured this based on the last valuation, just to show you the impact, which is $7,000 a year. But the city won't need to fund that until the 26-27 year.
Okay.
So when I'm here next March and I give you your updated valuation report, I'll show you this impact again, which is going to be right around that same $7,000, just as a reminder.
Is that a $7,000 increase?
Yes. Okay. Every year.
Not that that's what they're paying, because I was like, that seems like really low. So they're going to be paying possibly the $1,015,000.
Yes. So bottom line is, city's putting in $1 million a year. When I do the next valuation, I'll determine the new baseline. What it should be right around $1 million, the same. Okay. And then on top of that, we'll add $7,000. That's the impact of mortality. I call it a push. And when you're adding 7,000 out of $1 million, it's basically no impact, really. Very minor.
All right. And all of that basically was to the unfunded.
Yes.
It's just like a $6 increase to the normal cost.
Yeah, it's basically a retiree-only plan.
Great.
Just one active.
Interesting.
So when the unfunded's paid off, the impact of this is paid off in 15 years, so then the mortality impact is fully covered. But the cost of the plan is the checks that actually get paid out over the life of the plan. The assumptions have nothing to do with it. We're just trying to get a handle on using assumptions that match reality. But in the end, the cost of the plan is so. I would like it if actually everybody in Edgewater lived much longer than average, call it 100, then the true impact of the, you know, again, it has nothing to do with the mortality assumption. The true impact is measured by how long you pay the checks out. So now I'm getting a little too far down into actuarial rabbit holes here. So we'll part ways. We're updating the new assumption. The next valuation affects the city's 26-27 budgets. $7,000 a year. Okay.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank
pleasure.
You.
Thank you.
All right. Next up, we have Mr. Frank Wong with Burgess Chambers and Associates.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Brian.
I am here with quite a lot of good news. But as usual, if you go to PDF page 11 of the tablet there, you'll find a write-up that we typically talk about. It's something called BCA Market Perspective to kick off our quarter. So we decided to write about an interesting subject that we had been talking about as a board for quite some time, because we've always thought it was a difficult task to rank your plan as a closed plan against a lot of your peers. So if you recall, we decided to rank your plan against two different universes. And neither of them are really appropriate, but they provide a gauge. Well, this conversation comes back to the idea of how do we look against other public pension plans? Well, maybe about a year ago, I had shared the fact that other public pension plans have gotten really aggressive to the tune that we're uncomfortable with how this industry is morphing and where it's going. And then as of this past summer, Wall Street Journal finally echoed what we've been saying. And part of this has to do with the Ivy League school endowments, and the poster child was Harvard when they decided to pick on them. So in this write-up, if you go to the second paragraph, you'll see that Harvard University has roughly $53 billion in their endowment, which effectively means that, you know, these private schools, they really don't have to charge a tuition at all, right? If you have $53 billion, you can go out and invest in money market, you'll pay for every single kid's tuition free of charge, right? But that's not the point. I deviate. So out of that $53 billion, $23 billion are invested in something called private investments, private equity investments. So that's, you know, call it a little bit less than half, right? But close to half of it. And this is a similar trend that we have seen across the universe among larger pension plans, including the FRS. So the Florida state, you know, retirement system has about $175 billion at their discretion, of which 33%-ish is considered to be private. So as we think about your plan, how it's invested, mostly in stocks, bonds, a little bit of real estate, compared to some of your peers out there, stocks, bonds, others, that makes this world less symmetrical based on how we think about it. So how does that matter? Well, that matters because as we look at your plan, compare it against, say, the Florida retirement system last quarter, we look like idiots, right? So on paper, we ranked in the bottom 30th percentile. But this quarter, flip it around, we look like heroes. This quarter, we made 7%. Now we're in the top 30th percentile. So in one quarter, we look like idiots. Another one, we don't, right? So we can't flip-flop back and forth. And the reasons being is that if you think about what happened the last quarter, the market went down, it went right back up. So in these private investments, when the market goes back down, they don't tell you it went back down. They tell you it went up. Whereas we're recording the losses based on what you feel and what you see in the marketplace, it's more reflected on a real-time basis. Whereas if someone is invested, and let's say that I pick on Tim, for example, let's say Tim owns 100 dry cleaners around Volusia County. And he says, my dry cleaning business is worth $1 million each. His entire holdings, right, of 100 dry cleaners is worth $100 million. And that's what gets reported on paper. When the market goes down, he still is telling the world it's worth $100 million. So how do we know if Tim's lying or not, what is worth, right? Is if Brenda decides to buy Tim's business. So only when Tim sells, and maybe Brenda paid $125, right? That is a true value of what that business is worth. But what if Brenda only pays $50 million for it? Then suddenly the investors holding on to Tim's investments took a 50% loss. So this past summer, not only did we highlight the issue with Harvard, because they buy all these other type of businesses out there, they're not marketing it to the reality of it. And right now, part of this industry has a conflict because the industry takes the valuations from the operating partner or the general partner, meaning the Tims of the world. So whatever Tim reports to the Harvard University, Harvard says, that's what I think is worth as well. So then about 3 weeks ago, New York City Pension Program decides to put in $5 billion of their investments, that's private, for sale. This is the largest of this type of transaction in the marketplace. And they had these assets marked up 25% from where they started. So let's say they started at $4 billion, and now they're quoting these assets to be worth $5 billion. Well, what happened when they sold it last month? It was down. So they had to force a mark down by way of more than 12% loss. This is what they thought they were worth, and this is what the market ultimately bought it from New York pensions. So all this to say is that there's an incredible lack of transparency, but a brewing problem. Because the bigger these portfolios are, that means more of our public pension peers are not really being honest of what their assets are worth. Especially in light of what happened last quarter, we know we're marking losses, right? We lost 1% last quarter, whereas we saw other larger institutions saying that they made 3%. That is not possible, right? So as we look at how this is coming in the world is if more and more investors are forced to use liquidity, right? Whereas, for example, your investment policy statement says you can't go beyond 70% in stocks. And some of these universities says we can't go more than 50% in stocks, right? So as they need to rebalance the portfolio, they can't sell. But when they go to the open market, as they sell, are forced to sell, they're taking steep losses. And when that part of the portfolio grows so big, there's going to be more forced selling at the worst times. And that's going to crater a lot of these larger institutions when the time is probably at the worst point, when they're forced to do something. So again, that's a bit of a brewing problem, a bit of a dilemma that Wall Street is faced with right now. And fortunately, the Wall Street Journal is covering it. The Securities Exchange Commission is also covering this topic. So I would imagine there's going to be some reshaping in terms of how a lot of these private investments will be evaluated going forward as part of an independent practice. So in Europe, there's another governing body. And in Europe, they're starting a trend to say, well, not only do you take the valuations from the operators, you're also going to have to take a valuation from an independent appraiser, which is what we have in place for our real estate assets. Our, what we own through American Realty, through our real estate, is appraised independently. That is not happening in the private equity world, which will eventually happen. So again, there's a lot of discussions out there. I imagine that as the fact this the world is changing, right? We'll hopefully see some good that's going to come out of it. But in the meantime, again, this just reiterates the case that rankings may not matter as much for your plan, because now, as your peers do more different things and become more illiquid with their investments, we're just going to have to sit in this volatile periods where you're going to look like you're top this quarter, maybe bottom next quarter, but ultimately remembering that your plan has performed incredibly well against a conservatively invested peer group, okay? Just in different times, it's going to look a little different. So then let me reiterate some of those points. So I'm going to ask you to jump around these pages a little bit just to make a point here. On page 16 of our slide, or 26 of the PDF, 26 out of 58, or page 16 at the bottom of our report page numbers. So as you recall, this is universe number one, how we compare your plan, right? So as you know, we are conservatively invested with a model portfolio of 50% risk on and 50% risk off for your portfolio. Call it stocks, bonds, or stocks, bonds equivalent, roughly. So taking that approach, you'd be considered a conservative investor under the Morningstar universe allocations. So we rank you compared to how other investors that are similarly invested and how it would rank. And remember, your portfolio is rather simple. Most of your investments are in U.S. large cap, not foreign, right, which has been a winning source. And then on the second, we own traditional bonds and some real estate, again, which is very simple. That simplicity has been a source of win against your peers. And I think I talked about this before, right? Over the past 10 years, most of your peers on average held about 15 to 20% of their investments international. That has been a detractor away from their performance. Whereas we, as a plan, on average, has held between 7 to 10%. Right now, we're at the 7% mark. So having less international, more in domestic equities. So as we think about these winning factors, you'll see that your plan over the last 5 years has ranked in the top 10th percentile, earning a rate of return of 7.3%. Does everyone see that? So this is a pure universe of how they would invest, similarly to how we would invest, okay? Then you flip this upside down to the public pension universe. So I'm now going to lead your attention to page 12 of our report, or 22 of the PDF. And mind you that we're, you know, a conservative plan, right? Whereas most of your peer groups are about 70% invested in risk on or stocks and equities, right, where our target is about 50. So they're 20% more volatile in terms of how they would reinvest. So against a public universe, public pensions universe, over the last 5 years, you're ranked in the 90th percentile, but that's okay because we have met our goal, right, of 6.75% rate of return, which is more important for us. But what you'll find in the last year, for example, is that in the last year, we ranked in the 51st percentile. In the last quarter, we were 31st. Echoing what I mentioned before, last quarter, we were dead bottom, and now we're coming up to the top. So as your world, right, as the world of traditional equities continue to move up, in this case, just as we have seen in this portfolio, you're going to do much better, right? Whereas the private equity world this year, it's finally leveling off their markups. So prior to this year, okay, prior to the reason why they keep marking it up, is because interest rates have remained quite low up until 2023. So if Tim's business made 6% per year, and I'm his investor, right? His business is worth $100 million, right? I'm his investor. I put in my money along with his. I can go out and borrow money at a rate of 1% per year and help Tim to expand his operation from 50 to 100 satellites at a rate of growth of 5 to 6% per year. Not an issue, because I borrow my money at 1%. Most of these loans now, right, as you borrow it on a secure, unsecured basis, ranges between a rate of 6 to 12%. So if his business is only growing at 6%, am I taking a loss? Yes, pretty substantial, right? So that's now what we're faced with, is that a lot of these private investments, they're not giving returns, But they're being a little bit more honest. They're saying that, well, we made less than 5% over the last year. Whereas stocks, right, have gone up and up and up, marking a higher rate of return. And therefore, even as we persist on this path, right, 30% of our peers' assets have done nothing, right? And then rest of our assets have actually gone up. So even as conservative as we are, we're actually going to rank much better in the coming year than a lot of our peers because they're just stagnant and they can't do anything about it. So there's a lot of good in terms of having liquidity in your portfolio, but understand that as the market ebbs and flows, it typically wants to trend up. But your peers are just stuck, unfortunately, right? So some positive that's going to come out of this is because we're a closed plan, we need to pay a lot in benefits. We have a lot of needs to be able to access cash. We've actually been and set ourselves up in a pretty good position. Even though we're more conservative, we're still likely to outperform in the coming quarters or coming years. Does that make sense? So we're just in a kind of different light than a lot of our peers. But the prospect, as we rank against your more conservative peer group, still looks pretty bright out there. So on that note, again, we had a fantastic quarter, but this quarter was interesting. It was actually one that's short-lived because if I reported where you were at the end of April 8th, right? So if we just picked a different sensitivity point, at the bottom of April 8th, and I shared a report, you would have sat on a loss of 5%, right? I think I came, just shy of that day, in late March, right? And I was, talking about the volatility had really increased. Well, it increased in a good way. Because not only do we come out of that minus 5%, the market started to roar. And if you look at this asset class called Vanguard Growth Index, in this quarter alone, it had a 45% swing. At one point, this asset class was actually down 20 to 25%. And then even though it came back up, right? You remember, when you lose money, you got to make even more to bring yourself back to even. Not only did it break even, it actually came out ahead at a rate of return of 18%+. That's how volatile it was, right? But we actually forgot about this because now second quarter covers the span of 90 days, and we have just clocked in a good return, forgetting what happened in the beginning of April. But the volatility has always been here, right? It hasn't gone away. And I would suspect that the volatility will continue this week because the Fed is going to meet on Wednesday and they're likely to cut interest rates for the first time this year. So in theory, it should be good, right? Because think about asset classes that could benefit from interest rate cuts. Mortgage rates, right? Real estate could go up. So there's a lot of good that could come out of it. And as a result, investors are thinking very optimistically. So the market's going up because part of the reason is interest rates will be lower, borrowing costs will be cheaper, and the market and the prices of some of these goods will go up. However, this week will be volatile because people will read the tea leaves of what the Fed is going to say. There are reasons why we're going to increase or decrease rates, right? And in America, that the primary focus of rate changes is based on inflation expectations. So if we expect inflation to be tame, right now let's call it 2 to 3% range, then the Fed has ammunition to lower rates. We don't need rates to be at 4.5% when inflation's around 2.5%. But if we think inflation's going up, then the Fed is not going to cut rate again this year. So the lot is hanging on the minutes and the tea leaves of this meeting because right now, there are expectations that the Fed is going to cut on Wednesday and they're going to cut again in December. The December is a looming concern. And I think I mentioned that earlier this year, right? We may have one or two cuts, and that two cut, the second cut, is still looming out there. So if the tea leaves all says this week that there's likely to be another cut in December, the market's going to go up. But if people are reading through the minutes and reading through the Fed arguing each other about whether or not they're going to get a cut in December, and the chances are they may not get a cut, market's going to go right back down. So while a part of the market is excited about the the prospect of rate cuts, the stock market should go up. Another part of the market is not so excited, and they may be terrified by what is built in to this program, right, to our economy, and may not get the cut. And I say that because there are a lot of mixed data out there right now. And part of the mixed data that we have seen as a firm is the actual or the effective tariff rates that we have faced as a country. And we just don't know where that number will end up, right? And I gave an example at the last meeting that, hey, if you are a contractor, maybe you got ahead of the tariffs, you pre-ordered everything you need for the rest of this year, and you didn't pay that markup. You paid everything up front. You saved yourself from the markup and inflation. But at some point, the effective rate of what we pay in tariffs is going to go up as these deals are reached. So for the first quarter, it was maxed, right? Second quarter, it's actually gone up, but manageable. Third quarter, as the data come out, what we have seen is indication of the effective tariffs rate have actually increased by a tune of 15%, not 5% in the second quarter. So if that's the case, right, then companies like Ford, GMs of the world, or even dollar stores of the world, right, may have to eventually pass on those markups to us. Whereas this past quarter, remember, another reason why we didn't feel the impact of tariffs is they had actually absorbed it. Walmart took on a huge loss. GM and Ford took billions of dollars in losses because they absorbed it. But at some point, they're going to say, oh, we can only take so much, and we're going to pass it on, right? And if they pass it on, inflation could go up. So we're still in this kind of period between hard data and soft data, and the soft data, as they shape up, may not look as great, right? So that's what a lot of this will anticipate on, is whether or not the Fed is going to cut again in December. And therefore, if the Fed doesn't cut and the market's already expecting the Fed to cut, prices could fall. So a lot of volatility is to be had. But for the most part, right, as we have seen the U.S. economy and the hard data that's coming alive, our economy still remains incredibly strong. Unemployment rate, very strong, although it's softening, it's dampening. But overall, right, our economy remains very strong. Now, signs of cracks, there's always going to be those, right? Labor market is weakening. And I've actually seen a bit of the credit market weakening as well. I just saw a news over the weekend that average household has used up more than 22% of their available credit, which is a pretty high point compared to where we have been in the history. If people are realizing that they're running up against, you know, maybe borrowed monies, and there's only finite amount of borrowed money they could have, and they're already banging up against that 22%, they may want to pull back on some luxury expenses, right? Eating out, theme parks, travels, restaurants, right? So a lot of these leisure type of entertainments. So there are some signs that's creeping up. But for now, in general, our economy has remained, through this debate of tariffs, inflation, much better than a lot of our peers. So with that said, we have no recommendation on hand, but understand that as a firm and due to the position of your plan, as I mentioned before, we have proactively rebalanced some of your large cap portfolios just because it's gone up too high and too fast. We're just taking profits off it. That's it. Nothing crazy about what we've done. Right now, we stand about 11% overweight in stocks. So it only made sense that we're taking this ride up, and let's just trim it down, but we don't need to do it aggressively. So otherwise, again, the plan's in great, great health, and I suspect that we should close out with a fairly good third quarter as well.
Any questions?
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very, very, very much. Item number... or three, I guess. Ms. Bonnie.
Yes. Can you all hear me?
Very yeah, well, yes. Thank you.
Okay, great. So I have two memos, which are in the nature of just education. One of them will require some action in the future, but I'm just setting expectations. So during the last legislative session, there was a bill that was passed that affects local governments. But it is on a law that has been on the books for some time. So for some time, the Florida retirement system and the State Board of Administration, which invests the Florida retirement system money, has had a restriction on them that they cannot invest in companies that boycott Israel. And so they've created a scrutinized company list, which has companies that boycott Israel on it. Right now, there are 18 companies that are on the list. 12 of them are some form of Unilever across the world. Unilever is the parent company of Ben & Jerry's, and Ben & Jerry's, I think, pretty vocally has been boycotting Israel for some time. So they added to the requirements of an entity that can be found to boycott Israel, local governments. So you all, as a local government, for example, could be found to boycott Israel and be put on the entities that boycott Israel list. So we are recommending that you all follow the State Board of Administration's restrictions and add to your investment policy guidelines a provision that you will not invest in companies that boycott Israel. For you all and the way that you invest, it means very little. So because the requirement is that if you own shares in Unilever, for example, that you would tell your investment manager to sell those shares and to not invest any longer or again in Unilever until they come off the list. But because all of your investments are what's called indirect investments, which is that if you own Unilever, you own it through a mutual fund. You own it through a commingled type of investment. Your requirement is pretty simple. You would notify the manager that there is a list of scrutinized companies that the state would prefer that they not invest in, and that you have adopted that list, and ask them to make available to you an investment, a mutual fund investment, which does not contain the offending stocks. So this has been in place for some time for the police and fire plans with regard to companies that are complicit in issues going on in Iran and Sudan. And no mutual fund company, no commingled trust has ever made available an investment to be invested in. But if they do, if they change, you know, the way that they work and they decide to agree to make it that type of investment available, you would need to move over to that investment once it's made available. Again, I think that outcome is unlikely. But you don't have to take any action on that today. The secondary piece of that is that every contract that you enter into going forward will need to have a provision in it, which indicates that if the company that you're entering into business with is on the scrutinized company list, you have the choice of whether to terminate the contract and at no cost to you. It means very little also for you because you always have the right with almost all of your companies to opt out of a contract with basically 30 days notice. So does anybody have any questions about that?
Is this going to require a change to our policy in the future?
Yes. So we'll work with Frank to get a change to your investment policy guidelines, which would add a provision on the scrutinized companies. It would state generally about the direct versus the indirect, and that's basically it. And then we'd file it with the state.
Okay.
That's our recommendation to you. You can be an entity that's found to to be boycotting Israel. We don't know exactly what that means or how you get on the list, but we thought that it's good advice or prudent advice to follow the state into their policy.
Okay. Any other questions?
No.
Okay.
Sounds to me like another mandate from the state.
Yes.
That interferes with home rule again.
Yes. It's another in that line.
Yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Yes. The second is purely educational or informational. So the United States Supreme Court recently decided a case, and it involves a local governmental entity, and it is out of the state of Florida, so the city of Sanford. And it's something that you all are kind of familiar with, the substance of it. So this is about the health insurance that you are eligible to purchase from your municipality in retirement. In this particular case, the city of Sanford had a rule or a resolution that they had adopted with regard to the ability to purchase insurance. Retirees who are service retirees are entitled to buy the insurance and continue to buy the insurance until they reach age 65. But disability retirees are only eligible to buy that insurance for a two-year period of time. So there was a firefighter who went out on a non-duty disability. She had Parkinson's and was unable to perform her functions. After the two-year period of time that she was able to buy the insurance, and she was kicked off, she filed a lawsuit, and she filed it under the Americans with Disabilities Act. The United States Supreme Court clarified that she filed under the wrong lawsuit and so had no ability to recover or to get what she wanted out of the lawsuit that she filed, because the Americans with Disabilities Act says that you are a individual who can perform the functions of your job with or without a reasonable accommodation, whereas she is an individual who says, I can't perform the functions of my job with or without a reasonable accommodation. And so they dismissed it on that basis. They did not reach the subject, the substance of the case, right? Whether the city of Sanford can say that disability retirees can only have a two-year period to buy health insurance under the Florida statute, but normal retirements can buy that the health insurance until they reach 65. I'm interested in whether that can be the case, because I do have some cities that are offering the health insurance purchase for some limited period of time and not until they reached Medicare age. But I'm not aware that there is a state lawsuit dealing with that particular issue. And that's really all I have for you, unless you have questions.
Any questions?
No.
All right. Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Item number 5 is new business with the proposed meeting dates.
Bonnie's office prepares these dates with her schedule and based on the meeting schedule for last year. So same day of the week, and pretty much it just follows pretty much right in line. There is one thing that we wanted to address too.